On Sunday, it will be 25 years since Clarence Thomas took a seat on the Supreme Court. Thomas was controversial from the moment the first President Bush chose him in 1991 to become the nation's second black justice and succeed the first, civil rights icon Thurgood Marshall. Bush called the 43-year-old Thomas the most qualified person for the job, but Democrats quickly questioned that assessment and his judicial philosophy. Then came Anita Hill's claim that he had sexually harassed her while he was chairman of the EEOC. Thomas denied the allegations and blasted the Senate committee that aired the claims.
The Supreme Court is not worth it. No job is worth it. I'm not here for that. I'm here for my name, my family, my life, and my integrity. I think something is dreadfully wrong with this country when any person in this free country would be subjected to this. This is not a closed room. There was an FBI investigation. This is not an opportunity to talk about difficult matters privately or in a closed environment. This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow...
Thomas was narrowly confirmed, but has remained a polarizing figure, at least in the public eye. He is the court's most conservative justice, known for adhering to what he sees as the Constitution's original meaning and his willingness to overturn even established precedents. It's a stance that often leaves him writing solo dissents and concurrences. We will talk about Clarence Thomas and his legacy today with two people. Adam White is a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and Billy Courier is director of research for legal progress at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to you both. Adam, let me start with you. I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say you are an admirer of Justice Thomas. Tell us why.
Oh, I'm absolutely an admirer of Justice Thomas. And by the way, thank you very much for having me. I admire Justice Thomas in at least two respects. First, I think that his originalism is a very intellectually serious and brave endeavor. He's been at the forefront of it, and I'm saying this as somebody who often disagrees with him on how far to take originalism. I consider myself an originalist, but as Justice Alito once said, a practical originalist. Nevertheless, I'm very, very impressed by Justice Thomas's work throughout his career on the Supreme Court to push his views forward, often to serve as almost the conscience of the court in terms of criticizing its opinions when they depart from the original meaning. And second, I think Justice Thomas's personal story, beginning with his upbringing in poverty in Georgia, all the way through his time in school, and then his career both in public service in the state and federal level, I think is a very brave story and one that that Americans can learn a lot from.
Billy, I suspect you may have a somewhat different assessment of Justice Thomas's time on the bench. Do you agree or disagree with what we've just heard?
Well, I mean, I think we can all admire Justice Thomas's personal story of growing up in poverty in Pinpoint, Georgia, and making it to the highest court on the land. But I think that originalism is a sort of dangerous way to view the Constitution. I think that, you know, Justice Thomas has some pretty extreme views when it comes to the power of the federal government, and particularly when it comes to the power of the government to address racial discrimination. So I think that, you know, his philosophy is dangerous. I think that certainly he's been an influential justice, and he's sort of brought this originalism into the mainstream, I think, for a lot of conservatives. But it's definitely not a philosophy that I usually agree with.
Adam, aren't some of Justice Thomas's positions pretty far out there? So Billy mentioned, you know, federal power. He has said that the Establishment Clause involving religion doesn't apply to the states. He has said that the Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause doesn't prevent the abuse of prison inmates. Are those mainstream positions?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, I think by and large, Justice Thomas's views, to the extent that they map on to politics, and I don't think that he sees himself necessarily in that way, but to the extent that others do, I think that his views are very much in line with not just modern American conservatism, but I think heartland values in general. Now, with respect to his views on the issues you raised, on the question of whether the treatment of prisoners, how that's evaluated under the Eighth Amendment, I mean, I think there's a very serious intellectual argument there, namely that the original meaning of the Eighth Amendment with respect to cruel and unusual punishment went to punishments imposed by the government for a crime, and that the treatment of prisoners while they're in prison, no matter how terrible it might be, and it might raise other concerns in terms of deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process, that it's something that needs to be resolved under those areas of law or politically, and not by reinterpreting what the Eighth Amendment was originally intended to mean. Now, on the question of whether the Establishment Clause should apply to the states, I mean, obviously, on its face, the First Amendment does not apply to the states. It's limited to Congress's powers. And so the question is, should it be incorporated through the 14th Amendment? Now, I have to admit, I personally disagree with where Justice Thomas comes out on that. But I think it's a serious argument. And I think you don't do justice, not you personally, but critics don't do justice to Justice Thomas's approach when they try to take a thorough legal analysis and reduce it to a bumper sticker or a bullet point.
Billy, we have about 30 seconds, and we can talk more about this later. But would you agree that Justice Thomas, he's sort of been caricatured as somebody who follows Justice Scalia. He's certainly an independent thinker, is he not?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, I think that he is very much his own justice. He is not a clone or a puppet of Scalia. I think Clarence Thomas is an intellectual heavyweight. I mean, I think if you read his opinions, they're often very forceful and very persuasive in their own way, even though I don't agree with him usually. He's a strong legal mind, and he's very influential.
He's known for almost never asking questions from the bench, but when he does, it can be powerful, as it was in this 2003 argument about a Virginia law that made cross-burning illegal.
Now, it's my understanding that we had almost 100 years of lynching and activity in the South by the Knights of Camellia and the Ku Klux Klan. And this was a reign of terror, and the cross was a symbol of that reign of terror. My fear is that there was no other purpose to the cross. There was no communication of a particular message. It was intended to cause fear and to terrorize a population.
Our guests are Adam White of the Hoover Institution and Billy Courier of the Center for American Progress. Billy, what do we make of Justice Thomas in the issue of race? On one hand, we've heard he can speak perhaps like nobody else on the court to issues of racial discrimination and oppression. On the other hand, he is an ardent opponent of racial preferences.
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated. Obviously, Justice Thomas is the second African-American to serve on the court. And if you compare him to Thurgood Marshall I, they really have polar opposite views on a lot of issues involving race and civil rights. And it's really complicated. I mean, Justice Thomas dissented when the court upheld the University of Texas's affirmative action program. And he joined in the decision a few years ago to strike down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And that was an opinion in which Chief Justice Roberts basically said that racism in voting isn't a problem anymore, so we need to move on. I find his views on race really interesting. I usually disagree with where he comes down on these issues. But it's obviously a really complicated issue. And that cross-burning case that you played a quote from, I think, is one exception to Justice Thomas's general tendency, I think, to rule against, to rule against plaintiffs in civil rights cases, for example.
Adam, Justice Thomas has been called the least compromising of the justices, which leaves him writing, as we mentioned, a lot of solo dissents and concurrences. Do those have any impact on shaping legal thought at all?
I think so. Justice Scalia, to be clear, often said that he was writing, his dissents and concurrences were written for the next generation of lawyers, and I think the same is true of Justice Thomas. There's an interesting interview that's going to come out on Monday, an hour-long conversation between Justice Thomas and Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard, where Justice Thomas gets into his approach to writing solo dissents and concurrences rather than joining on to others where he might have to compromise. And I think it shows that Justice Thomas does have a pretty principled and thought-out approach to this. And I think he understands that, ironically, for somebody who doesn't ask questions at oral argument, his voice is uniquely powerful, especially on a few issues such as his view of affirmative action.
Billy, there's a new Smithsonian Museum here in Washington. It's devoted to African Americans and African American history. And there is no Clarence Thomas exhibit at that museum. I haven't been there, but I understand there is a display of Anita Hill. Can that possibly be an accurate reflection of his importance in American life?
Well, you know, I haven't been to the museum either. There's a pretty long waiting list, I think, to get in. But I think it's very appropriate to honor Anita Hill in the museum and to mention her allegations against Clarence Thomas, I think. You know, it's hard to deny that Clarence Thomas is one of the most powerful African-Americans in America right now as a justice on the Supreme Court. You know, at the same time, I don't know how they made the decision of who to include and who not to include in the exhibits. But, you know, it does seem like it's sort of an obvious absence from the museum, at least. You know, I mean, it's very complicated.
Billy, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. Billy Corrier of the Center for American Progress, Adam White of the Hoover Institution, talking about the legacy of Clarence Thomas.